from KQED.
Good morning. I'm Penny Nelson, and this is the California Report. The stage is set for a razor-close vote at the California Capitol today on a $52 billion road repair and transportation funding deal. As KQED's politics and government reporter Kitty Orr tells us, Democratic leaders are pulling out the stops in an effort to get the bill passed.
Because Senate Bill 1 would raise taxes, it requires a two-thirds vote to pass. Democrats hold two-thirds majorities in the state Senate and Assembly, and they'll need almost all of those votes to get this transportation bill through both houses.
Everywhere we go!
On Wednesday, as a large group of construction workers cheered them on, Governor Jerry Brown joined with Assembly and Senate leaders at a rally aimed at pushing the measure across the finish line. Brown says there are a lot of issues in the Capitol that lawmakers can put off, but transportation infrastructure isn't one of them.
When it comes to fixing roads that are falling apart, or that bridge down there in Monterey County that no longer can support a car, you got to do it now. And if you don't do it, it gets more expensive next year and the year after.
The bill would raise the money for road, freeway, and bridge repairs by gradually increasing car registration fees and taxes on gas and diesel. That formula has turned off Republicans who say they've been left out of negotiations. Some moderate Democrats also have concerns, leaving the fate of the bill very much up in the air as a vote draws near. For the California Report, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
Well, it's no surprise that Republicans and Democrats have very different views of President Trump. But as KQED's senior editor for politics and government, Scott Schaefer, reports, a new poll finds that those partisan differences are seeping into perceptions of news coverage.
The Berkeley IGS poll asked California voters how much trust and confidence they have in the media. The answers were polar opposite each other. While nearly 80% of Republicans have little or no trust in the media, 75% of Democrats do trust the job journalists are doing. Pollster Mark DiCamillo says when it comes to attitudes about news coverage, Republicans and Democrats seem to be living in alternate universes.
Very huge 40, 50 point differences between the views of Democrats and Republicans. Used to be that you would only get those kinds of differences on, you know, political campaigns involving Democrats versus Republicans or very partisan issues.
Not surprisingly, the survey finds that while 84% of Republicans say the coverage of President Trump has been too critical, 62% of Democrats say it hasn't been critical enough. Of course, this comes as President Trump has been railing against what he calls fake news and calling the media enemies of the American people. Pollster Mark DiCamillo says it doesn't bode well for the future.
You know, it's just a long-term problem for the country, and I do think it poses threats to the health of democracy.
In general, California voters express much more faith in the media than the nation as a whole, but that's mostly a reflection of the state having so many Democrats and relatively few Republicans. For the California Report, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Meanwhile, a bill to make California a so-called sanctuary state is making its way through the legislature. Like similar local laws, Senate Bill 54 would limit cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Now, keep in mind that San Francisco was one of the first cities in California to adopt a sanctuary policy, and that was nearly 30 years ago. KQED politics and government reporter Marisa Lagos has this look at the history and the controversy behind it.
The debate began in the 1980s. Civil wars raged in Central America, and churches began providing refuge to fleeing immigrants. The Reagan administration refused to recognize them as asylum seekers, so cities stepped up. Dozens, including San Francisco, began adopting informal policies prohibiting local officials from cooperating with immigration enforcement. San Francisco Sheriff Vicki Hennessy was working as a deputy in the jail back then.
Up until that time, ICE agents, or at the time immigration agents, were allowed to come into our jails and check all the booking cards and see who and question anybody they wanted to question.
The city's early sanctuary policies stopped those visits, but they didn't stop immigration officials and San Francisco police from teaming up to raid a Latin dance club in 1989. Dozens of people were handcuffed and detained for hours at Club Elegante, including many U.S. citizens, says former San Francisco Assemblyman Tom Amiano.
It was obvious that this was a big snafu that should have never happened.
Ammiano says the raid awakened a sleeping giant.
That was it. Boom. It was a benchmark.
Civil rights attorney Robert Rubin helped write what would become San Francisco's sanctuary city law later that year and says even the city's conservative police chief was on board.
It wasn't even so much that he loved immigrants. It was, I think, more a sense of we need this type of policy because without it, we lose the trust and cooperation of the immigrant community that we're devoted to serve.
Rubin and others working in the city at the time say the federal government pushed back against these policies, even threatening to jail city leaders or strip federal funding. But as time passed, the city's law remained. And nearly two decades later, in June 2008, the shocking murders of a local man and his two sons shook San Francisco to the core.
Cops say Edwin Ramos, shown here, is the killer. A suspected MS-13 gang member here illegally from El Salvador.
Danielle Bologna lost her husband, Tony, and two of her four kids in a heart-wrenching case of mistaken identity. Within weeks, conservative pundits came calling. Here's Danielle Bologna on the talk show of conservative commentator Laura Ingraham a month after the murders.
This should happen to any family. We did everything right, but yet these immigrants have more rights than we do.
San Francisco's sanctuary law was immediately blamed after reports that the shooter, Edwin Ramos, was convicted of two violent felonies as a juvenile, but wasn't handed over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The revelations fanned the flames of anger among critics. San Francisco's mayor, Gavin Newsom, rushed to change city policy and started handing over any undocumented kid merely accused of a felony to immigration officials, even though adult suspects were still protected. That was later changed by the Board of Supervisors. But in those early months, Tom Ammiano says, a key fact was lost in the flurry of outrage.
And it was the feds who dropped the ball.
Bologna family friend Marty McGee agrees. She says ICE knew exactly who and where the Bologna shooter was because he was the subject of a federal gang investigation.
They knew where he worked. They knew where he lived. They knew where he hung out. They knew where he committed criminal activities. They were following him around.
But the Ramos case was just one turn in a debate that still rages over how this liberal city should handle people without legal status in the United States. Despite the controversy, a recent poll shows that San Franciscans overwhelmingly support the law. And now, California lawmakers are considering expanding some of those protections statewide. For the California Report, I'm Marisa Lagos.
Federal directives implemented by President Obama blocked a private company's plan to pump groundwater out of the Mojave Desert and sell it in Southern California may now be reversed by the Trump administration. Cadiz Incorporated's pumping plans stalled following a 2015 decision by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, a decision that required the company to build a pipeline over federal land, which meant a long and expensive environmental impact review. Cadiz's request for the BLM to reverse the decision were declined by the Obama administration, but the current president seems open to it. Los Angeles Times reporter Bettina Boxall is here to explain what a reversal of the policy and such pumping would mean. Well, Bettina, first, could you just explain what Cadiz Incorporated wants to do and what the obstacles the Obama administration put in their way were?
Cadiz, which is a private company that owns about 34,000 acres in the Mojave Desert, wants to create a pumping project where they would pump groundwater from their holdings and transport it to the Colorado River Aqueduct and sell it to communities in Southern California. And they were seeking to put their pipeline on a federal right-of-way, railroad right-of-way, and the federal government, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, last year, or in 2015, said they couldn't do that. And what the Trump administration has done is to rescind some legal guidances that underpinned that decision that said that they could not use the railroad right-of-way for their pipeline.
And it was really Cadiz's choice to not go forward with the environmental impact review, not an absolute block put up by the administration. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, they didn't kill, the federal government did not kill the project, but they threw up a major roadblock, which the Cadiz pumping project, you know, would very much like to get around it, because not only would it be costly and expensive, but federal review might impose pumping limits on their project that would make the project less profitable.
Now, what are some of the scientific concerns around pumping water out of the Mojave Desert?
Cadiz holdings are completely surrounded by federal public land, including some nearby wilderness areas and the Mojave National Preserve. And the rain and the runoff that helps to replenish the aquifer from which Cadiz is going to pump comes from under those public lands. And so there is concern that the pumping would draw down the level of the groundwater and would dry up some springs that are vital to wildlife, including some endangered species in the surrounding public land.
So how much water are we talking about?
We're talking about enough water to supply 100,000 homes every year. And they would, you know, are planning this project for at least 50 years and at least in theory could gain revenue of $1 to $2 billion over that period of time.
How much control do our local leaders, our statewide leaders, have on these issues? Can the governor step in?
I don't really think so, because it's on private land and they have gotten approval from San Bernardino County, which supervises, you know, oversees groundwater use in that area. And the surrounding land is federal. It's not state. So it really is more of a federal issue.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Bettina.
You're quite welcome.
And finally today, a small youth mariachi group from the Central Valley is heading to play at one of the world's most famous music venues. Mariachi Mestizo from Delano has been invited to play at New York's Carnegie Hall on Monday. The ensemble is made up of 14 musicians, all of whom are between 10 and 20 years old. Mariachi Mestizo has been crowdsourcing donations to help fund their trip east. And once they get to New York, the group says they'll be the first mariachi group from California to debut at the legendary concert venue since the 1960s.
Support for the California Report comes from Personal Capital, offering online financial tools to manage and track accounts from investments to retirement planning. Personal Capital, serving over 1 million people at personalcapital.com. Barracuda Networks, cloud-ready firewalls engineered for today's next-generation business networks. Learn more at barracuda.com/cloud-ready. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
And that's the California Report for Thursday, April 6th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Penny Nelson.